Okay, so who am I? Am I a person that's totally depraved, or do I have some kind of good in me? It's rather confusing. I remember early in my life I was taught that I was just totally depraved, and I couldn't accept that because I did see some good stuff in my life. In fact, I saw all good stuff in my life.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Jack, people throw around all sorts of different terms that I don't really understand, and I'm hoping that other people out there don't understand, because I'd like to ask about them. People would call you at first glance a Calvinist. And then there's another camp called Arminians. How about if you help us out? Explain what those terms mean.
Okay. A Calvinist would be somebody who subscribes to the teaching, the doctrines, the systematic theology of John Calvin and his immediate predecessors, who kind of formulated a theological paradigm for looking at the Bible. And I'm... strictly speaking, I'm not a Calvinist, because that has not been the tradition that nurtured me. I have read, I could probably count on two hands the number of pages of Calvin that I've read. As much as I respect him for what I understand that he said and what I have read, I certainly have not been tutored by Calvin. And there are all kinds of things that are a part of Calvinistic theology that I would have serious disagreement with. So I'm not really, strictly speaking, a Calvinist, although two doctrines are kind of notable in Calvinism. I mean, when people think of Calvinism, they think of one of two things, probably. Either his view of the sovereignty of God, and although we haven't talked about that a lot in our radio program here, I would be very Calvinistic in my view of the sovereignty of God. And then the other is Calvin's belief in what they call total depravity, how thoroughly and completely evil we are. And in that regard, people might think of me as a Calvinist because, as I've been saying for the last several sessions, we're thoroughly evil and we need to come to recognize that.
And we need to come back to that in a few minutes, because I think we'd like to spend some time on total depravity. That relates to our series and what's it look like to be a believer. And one of the things that happens when we're a believer is it changes how we view ourselves.
Right.
And one of them is that we are totally depraved. But before we get into that, can you go back to the distinction? What is an Arminian, then?
Okay, an Arminian is somebody who prefers the theology that was developed by Jacob Arminius, a Dutch theologian who was kind of raised in the Calvinistic tradition a few generations after Calvin, who didn't like Calvin's views of the sovereignty of God and was insistent on human freedom and human autonomy, and developed a kind of counter theology to Calvin based on his commitment to the free will of man, the free will of man that was free from the sovereignty of God, that God had so created the world that God limited himself to not in any way be determinative of the choices and actions and behavior of a human being. So based on his commitment to that view of human freedom, he kind of reformulated Calvinism, and that's what we call Arminianism.
So there's these two different camps, and it kind of sounds to me like you're not really a believer of anyone wholly.
Right, yeah, I don't. I have formulated my beliefs based upon my study of the New Testament, and I appreciate a lot of the different insights of a lot of the different traditions in various respects, but I'm not wholly committed to any of them, right?
And I just want to make a point here that how much I don't understand these things. I was saying Arminian, and I don't even know how to say the word right,
yeah,
do
it's
I?
Arminian.
It's Arminian.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay, that's how far off I am. So everybody else, you guys have permission to not understand this stuff either. Okay, so, but we did want to talk today about the total depravity of man, which happens to be a Calvinistic concept.
Right, right.
So what do you mean by that?
Well, that's a good question. And as
thank you very much. I like asking good questions.
I can't speak to kind of the scholarly debate or scholarly commentary on that because I'm just not familiar with it. So I'm going to give the kind of homespun on the street understanding that I have developed. And that is that we really have a dilemma here, that we have to decide if we are totally depraved and...
Wait a minute. We better go back to what depraved means.
Are we totally broken? Are we totally...
sinful, evil,
yeah,
wrong?
Yeah, it has to do with our evil and our wickedness and our sinfulness, that we are wrong to the core of our being. I mean, that's what it's trying to get at. It's the sort of thing that we talked about when we referred to Romans 1, where it says God gave us over to degrading passions, and God gave us over to a depraved mind, that our brokenness extends to the way we think, the way we see things, our attitudes, our desires, that everything in us is broken. Now, the problem, though, is this term total. What exactly are we meaning? What are the practical daily implications?
Yeah, does that mean that every single thing that we ever do ever is bad?
Right, that's the question. I mean, one way of taking it would be that I can't open my mouth without somehow the words coming out being tainted with evil. And I can't open my eyes without somehow my perceptions of reality and my thoughts being tainted with evil. And no matter what I do, no matter how noble my goal and my purposes and my motives, everything I do is somehow tainted by evil.
And that's what Calvin says.
Well, that would be one way to interpret what Calvin is saying,
mm-hmm.
or at least one way to interpret that doctrine. As I say, I don't actually know what Calvin said about that. But as it's come down to us in the 20th century, one conclusion that your average Christian draws from that doctrine is that literally everything is tainted. Everything that we do is tainted.
And so, according to our discussion right before we went on the air, if someone hears or thinks that you're a Calvinist, they might throw you out completely because they don't believe that.
Right.
That
right.
They just think that people who believe in total depravity are just downer people. They just want to get rid of them because all they think is everything we do is bad.
Kind of theological Eeyores. That,
well, worse than Eeyores, but at
yeah.
least. Okay.
and I used to believe that. I mean, that's sort of the perspective that I took for many, many years, is that that's what Paul was saying, that was what the Bible was teaching.
That every single thing that I do, every word that comes out of my mouth is tainted with evil, period.
Right, right. Now, the problem is, of course, how do you justify those things that you do that seem right and seem good and seem appropriate and seem noble? Well, I have what you have to believe, if you believe in total depravity in that sense, is that, yeah, it seems noble, and it is, for the most part, but there's just this layer there of self-centeredness, of greed, of some kind of motivation that is tainted by evil. There's a layer that may not be obvious, it may not be on the surface, it may not be explicit, it may not even be something you could ever find through introspection and analysis, but you got to know it's there.
So it would even mean that the mundane things of life, like you and I talking right now, would be absolutely be tainted with evil.
Right.
There's nothing on the surface that I can see right now that I'm doing that's wrong or broken. But a person who believes in that kind of total depravity, that it taints everything that we do, would even taint this conversation as
right.
right now.
Right.
So we couldn't find anything good anywhere
right.
at its core.
Yeah. Certainly the idea being that as God sees it, and as God sees my heart as I am active in this world, what I'm doing is not commending itself to God, because he's seen through all the layers, and he recognizes that there are layers in there that are motivated by evil desires and evil attitudes.
Okay, so that's one way to look at total depravity. What's another way?
Okay, the other way would be to see us as totally broken in the sense that we are completely completely incapable of doing what a human being is supposed to do, namely, to be always good. Let me. An example I've used in my teaching is, if I make a machine that's supposed to make widgets, if it doesn't make widgets, then it's broken. It shouldn't come as any surprise to me when it does make a widget, because that's what it was made to do. A widget machine that's designed to make widgets should make widgets, and I don't really compliment it every time it makes a widget. It's just doing what it's supposed to do. When it is unsuccessful at making a widget, I call it broken, and I think it needs to be fixed. Another way of looking at total depravity would be to say that in every important and significant respect, we are broken, which is to say, in every significant respect, with respect to my attitudes, my perceptions, my desires, my behavior, my thoughts, everything is broken and therefore does not successfully reflect the glory of God in everything that it does, even though, as a human creature, that's what I was made to do. I was made to be thoroughly and uncompromisingly good, thoroughly and purely
perfectly,
godlike.
Perfectly good.
Yeah. So to the extent that I don't do that, to that extent, I'm a broken creature. I'm not the creature that I was intended to be and designed to be. The depravity is total because it permeates every aspect of my existence. As I said, my thoughts, my attitudes, my behavior, my desires. At any given point, put me in the right situation and you're going to see terrible attitudes, terrible perceptions, terrible behavior, terrible desires, thoroughly ungodlike in every respect. And the question is, if God created me to be godlike, where is that other stuff coming from? Why is it there? Well, it's because I'm broken. I'm morally broken. That perspective has a lot going for it, a lot to recommend it, I think. It doesn't have the problem that the other view does, in that if I were to do something kind or something compassionate or something noble, it's not really in conflict with the doctrine, because the doctrine, understood that way, is not saying we are incapable of doing good. It's just saying we are capable of doing evil, and that is a problem. That's a huge problem. And I should say stronger, more than capable of it. Give me enough time and I inevitably will do evil.
Okay, well, you're going to have to forgive my short-sightedness, but I don't really see the difference in those two views.
Well, let me give you a practical example. Let's say that I just did something kind for someone. On the first view, as you watch this go down, as you watch this happen, you would look at that and your theology would say, well, it looked like he was being very compassionate and very kind there, but I know better than that. I know that in the final analysis, there are motives at work, there are attitudes at work, there's some layer down inside Jack's heart that is evil in its motivation. He's wanting to get something that a human being shouldn't even desire, shouldn't even want to have. Some kind of glory, some kind of self-glorification, some kind of self-justification. Something is going on that is fundamentally evil. If you have the second view, you look at it and you go, that's really nice. It's good that he does that. Aren't we amazing creatures that God made, that we are capable of that kind of nobility and that kind of beauty in the actions and attitudes that we take toward one another? And you could still turn around and say, we are totally depraved creatures, and Jack is a totally depraved creature, and that wouldn't be a contradiction.
Because Jack could do that nice thing right then, but the reality is he is broken.
Yeah.
And tomorrow or next minute, he could do something equally
cruel. Exactly.
So he can do something good sometimes, and he'll do cruel things other times. He'll be good, and he'll be bad. We're a mix of the two.
Yeah, and that's a mind-boggling reality. How can someone so capable of that kind of nobility and morally beautiful action the next minute be so cruel? What a mind-boggling reality. And that's one way of understanding the doctrine of total depravity, is that we are polluted, totally polluted, in the sense that this intrinsically wonderful creature that God made is constantly fouling the waters of his own life by his actions.
And I guess at the same time also making beautiful the world by his actions.
Right.
Both are occurring.
Right.
To a greater or lesser degree with different people and in different circumstances.
In his article, Treasuring These Things in Our Hearts, Jack Crabtree reflects on two aspects of the Christmas story that just don't make sense. On the one hand, the birth of Jesus is accompanied by a dramatic fanfare of angels singing, ordinary people prophesying as to Christ's identity and significance, and wise men traveling from the other side of the world to do homage to him. On the other hand, when Jesus begins his public ministry years later, he emerges from relative obscurity to present himself to a skeptical nation that didn't seem to have the slightest idea who he was and what he had come to do. How can the public be so utterly without a clue as to who Jesus is when God made it so clear with events surrounding his birth? In this article, Jack discusses how easy it is to believe that Jesus is the promised king because a whole chorus of angels are singing his praises in a dramatic display of divine power. However, it is much more difficult to believe that Jesus is the promised king when life's circumstances are closing in on you, when you have lived for years with no solutions to your most urgent problems, when angels are conspicuously silent, when God seems so far away, so preoccupied, and so deaf, and when no signs in the heavens are telling you anything at all. Jack stresses that if we believe deeply and profoundly within our own hearts that what is transpiring at Christmas is the most important thing the world will ever know, then truly we have come to believe in the importance of Christmas. Call the McKinsey Study Center for your free copy of the article, Treasuring These Things in Our Hearts, by Jack Crabtree.
So Jack, last time that we recorded, you said what I really want to talk about next time is to address this question, that being a sinner means that everything I do is tainted with evil. Why is it that this is such an important question to you?
Well, my view, the one that I'm leaning toward right now, is somewhere between those two views, in the sense that I think what I used to believe, that everything literally is contaminated by evil, every action we take, what it has going for it is it encourages us to be realistic, to be profound in our analysis of our own actions and not superficial. It encourages us to recognize that it's meaningful to think in terms of kind of layers in my motives, and therefore is an aid to me coming to this awareness that I am, in fact, an ungodly and unrighteous creature that otherwise might escape my notice if I only look at the superficial veneer of my actions. So I think we talked about this in prior sessions, where piety, for example, of one kind or another, where I really work at presenting myself as religious and godly and God-loving and church-going, decent person, that's just the veneer of my life, though. That's just the public image that I'm giving. But what's really going on in my life? Deeper down, what kinds of envy and jealousy and bitterness and greed is really motivating me? Well, if I just have the view that I'm, you know, basically a good person created by God to be a noble and beautiful creature, and offer up my religiosity as exhibit A of what a wonderful creature I am made by God, then I'm not allowing myself to look any deeper and see what's really there. So I think oftentimes my actions are tainted at levels and at layers that may escape my notice if I'm not willing to be ruthless in my investigation and introspection.
And I think people could be asking at this point, why would I want to look deeper? Why would I want to look at layers underneath? And that's certainly a question I had early on in my Christian life. Mm-hmm. I certainly didn't think I had a veneer that I was looking at, but I did. In fact, I think I went to a Christian college, and I think they, as far as I can remember, they taught me to have this veneer. And I asked them, why do we have to wear dresses on campus? And they said, because if any non-Christian from outside came in, they would see that we are good people. They would see that we are respectable people. And I guess there's some truth on some level, but I think that permeated what they were teaching, was that there was this veneer that we needed to create in order to show people our righteousness. And I came to believe that it really was righteousness, that I had all these things that I was doing and actually doing quite well. But what I missed in it was these layers, as you say, beneath the surface, that have made me come to understand that that really simple statement that seemed like such a cliche, you can't do it on your own, because I realized that I didn't understand my need at that time. All I understood was what I could do to make myself look really good, and I thought it was good, but I didn't understand my need for God because everything looked good. Now as I look underneath at the layers, I have a whole lot more humility, a gazillion times more humility, because I really see the sin that permeates, that brokenness that you're talking about, that really, really permeates my life.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why it's so important to look.
Right.
Apart from that, I really don't need God. I really don't see it. I really don't understand how great God's mercy is, because, you know, I'm doing okay.
Right.
The cross doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me when I'm only looking at the veneer or the exterior of my life.
Right. And all that's ultimately to say, because it's true. I mean, I need to look deeper and see the real stuff that's going on down there, because it's the truth.
It's also the truth.
Yeah.
You know, that sin is underneath. I want to say also, because there's also this other stuff that's going on that is, there is some good that is happening also.
Right.
Very definitely in my life.
Right. Although in the example that you gave, would, I mean, maybe
not
I should ask
veneer.
You, would you, yeah, the veneer, you wouldn't put
no,
to
I
that
wouldn't
as
call
a
that,
good.
I wouldn't,
right.
Maybe there was a good part of it in the mm-hmm. sense that I was trying to do what was right. I was trying to obey the teaching as I was perceiving it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a good thing. I was going at what I thought God wanted for me. I think I was misled or misunderstood, but nonetheless, that was a good thing.
Right. Well, that's why I said, you know, your last comment is about also the evil, because it's also true that is the good. It's what makes me lean toward that other view as well, or at least want to acknowledge some insight that's important in that other view, and that is, it's not that because there are these layers where evil is at work in my actions, it's not as if I can't look at an action, and if I come to the conclusion, wow, that really was good, that I need to keep looking deeper until I find the evil, that it really is okay to come to the conclusion that thing you did there was actually just plain good, that was a good thing, the sort of thing that God created you to do. Otherwise, we can become so cynical and so skeptical with respect to ourselves that we come to the conclusion that there is no good in the world, there is no good in me at all. And whereas I was inclined in that direction at one point in my life, I just don't think that's true. And I don't think there's anything that the Bible is teaching about human evil that requires us to see life that way. That it really shouldn't surprise us that there is good in the world, because look at the God who created this world. Look at the God who created human beings. The fact that a maternal instinct, for example, should be so self-sacrificial, that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. The fact that we are capable of deep and profound friendship, that's a good and wonderful, godly kind of thing in this world. And we don't have to be sanctified people to experience aspects of profound friendship. The thing that is so strange, the thing that is so mysterious in this world, is the fact that a bond as deep and profound as friendship can be sabotaged and corroded and undermined to such an extent that people that are good friends one day, 10 years later, could hate each other. Well, where'd that come from? If friendship is such a powerful bond, what could possibly tear it apart? It's this thing called sin. That's constantly coming to play, is constantly entering into my life and bringing the good things of my life to naught, just wrecking them and destroying them. So instead of taking the view that friendship is really evil, I think we can fully acknowledge the truth that friendship is a wonderful creation by God. But total depravity means, but there's this other reality at work in me also, which is what you said. There's this other reality at work in me also that tends to destroy and sabotage and undermine all the good things in my life.
And Jack, I think that we tend to emphasize one side or the other more. It seems like in particular churches, they'll emphasize that we are this broken person, and in other churches they'll emphasize that we are people who really are capable of doing good, that we are made in the image of God and are beautiful creatures. And maybe neither side, neither church will reject either side of that, but they'll tend to emphasize one side or the other. I was thinking about that too in terms of my life. I tend to emphasize my sinfulness. And I think the reason that I do that is because I have such a tendency toward narcissism, to seeing myself better than I am, really having this need to look at myself and think, man, that was really great. And really, the first part of my life, having that be a huge part of how I lived. And so now, it seems like to keep myself in balance, I look more toward this, my own sinfulness rather than all the good that I'm doing. Though, I guess as I'm talking, I'm thinking, well, maybe I'm starting to balance out. I need to, you know, I've looked so much at the sinfulness of my life that I need to really maybe go in the middle again and see more good. But I think that's why we have these different emphases, and we want to say, you know, you're wrong or you're wrong, and that's not it. I think lots of times it comes out of our need to see different aspects. Mm-hmm. Like I think somebody who has only been condemned and seeing their sinfulness and being told of their sinfulness and very aware of that and even have severe self-degradation as a part of their mental complex, that they then need to be somebody who really has an overabundance of understanding God's grace, God's mercy, and alongside that, the good that they are doing.
And their nobility as a creature.
Yes. And they, in a sense, I have someone that I talk to often, and I often say to this person, you just need to give yourself a break. You know, you need to see some of what's good here, because all you see is the evil part of yourself, and that can destroy a person. Mm-hmm. To only see the bad, they cannot. It's staggering.
Yeah, and I think we've talked about this before, but it's, I think, a point worth reviewing again, and that is ultimately self-rejection or self-hatred is itself an act of rebellion against God. Because the truth is, what the Bible tells us is, that we were creatures created in the image of God. And part of, this is not all that it means, but I think part of what that means is, we are created to be creatures with real nobility and real worth as creatures. For us to come along and say, no, I don't have any worth as a creature, is just to look God in the face and say, you're a liar. You don't know what you're doing. You're an incompetent creator.
In my case,
I don't like what you've done.
I'm going to come to their defense, because there's two levels that we act on. Maybe in our mind we can know that is an act of rebellion, but we also have I want to call it this gut level, emotional level, where our head can say as much as it wants. I understand that I have value in God's eyes and I am made in the image of God. But in their gut, they just cannot get it. And there is a complete division between those two parts of themselves. They need to be brought together and integrated. But so many people live on that level, where their head knows something, but their gut, their emotions, their heart can't get it. They cannot grasp it as much as they want to. And the heart and the gut is not in rebellion. It's just suffering. It's just wanting to get where the head's at, but it just can't seem to get there.
Right, right. What do they need to do? How do they need to proceed?
That's a really hard question, and I'm going to give a simple answer to it, which is not complete at all. But at the gut level, people need to expose themselves and have themselves at the gut level, unhidden, vulnerable, seen, and loved. Accept it. And when that reality becomes a part of what I'm calling their gut knows, their gut feels, over time, they can experience a blending of what their head knows and what their gut knows. In a sense, it's kind of a reality check. That makes sense?
Are they completely at the mercy of other people at that point? I mean, could they experience that love from God Himself if other people fail them?
Theoretically, I have to say absolutely yes. And people are a big part of our lives, and right. I think that God uses people to give us that. Are we without hope if there's no people in our lives that do that? I don't think so. It can't be true. But I sure do see me as having a huge responsibility to love people who at their gut think they are unlovable.
Right, right. Presumably, I'm going to step out of my field and expertise here, but I would assume that that emotional gut-level response has been, in a sense, created in them by the way they've been treated by other people for the most part.
Yes.
So they're there to start with because other people have rejected them, have told them that they are unlovable. And so what you're saying is a very important piece of the antidote is to undo that by others of us loving them and appreciating and acknowledging their dignity and their nobility as individual creatures made by God.
And loving them not with the veneer that they've put out so that people
right.
will accept them, but loving them at the level where they think they can. They are absolutely unacceptable.
So they have to be persuaded that I'm not loving them because they're being an effective actor.
Right.
They need to be persuaded that I'm loving them for who they actually are in their basic raw nakedness, in a sense.
Right. And only persuaded because I'm with them there in it. We've
right.
built such a safety in our friendship, our relationship, that they have exposed who they are. And they're sitting, as you say, vulnerable, naked, and they're okay. Over and over and over again, we're experiencing that I'm valued even though this is who I am. And lots of times, who they are isn't any different than who I see myself to be or
right.
anyone else. But they have been so rejected with who they are that they can't imagine that if they opened up and showed who they were, anybody would come next to them. So what they do instead is they hide through alcohol, through sleep, through any number of veneers, through being compulsive, workaholics, on and on and on.
Do you ever encounter a situation where someone is, well, maybe they would never get there if this were the case, but it seems to me theoretically possible, at least, that someone could be loved by you for who they are, for the magnificent creature that they are, and yet they would just simply refuse to love themselves. Do you ever experience that, or
you mean refuse to love themselves? I don't know what you mean by that. You mean that their head would say, "I will not be loved," or their gut
yeah.
is unable to let it in.
Well, that their gut is unable to let it in, but their gut is unable to let it in because their head, because there's some kind of hard, stubborn resistance to me being lovable.
Both have happened.
Okay.
There is this hard, stubborn resistance. And oftentimes, though, Jack, it isn't that they recognize that they are being hard and stubborn. What happens is that they see me as being an awful person and find a way to really reject me rather than and I think it's just because they're so afraid to get to this core level, and they're sure they're going to be rejected, so they find a way to reject me first. And I'm talking as a counselor in this kind
mm-hmm,
of situation.
Right.
So, yeah, there's this stubborn, I cannot, I will not do it. And I don't think it's a conscious thing, and it grieves me incredibly. Quite honestly, that hasn't happened a lot in my counseling. I can probably count on one hand. And I just think I have been given by God a special group of people that want, lots of times they struggle in their gut, and there is this huge difference between what their head knows and what their heart feels or what their gut knows. But most often, people are really working hard at trying to understand this sense of, bring these two parts of them together, and they might experience me for years caring about them, but they have been so incredibly wounded that their gut just cannot, they just can't buy it. And yet, I think that's the biggest faith when I see this, because they're trying, they want to, they're working at it, they're pursuing it, they just can't find it. And I think for some people, they won't until eternity. They just, it's just too deep, it's too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's not a cure, there's not a healing completely for a lot of people.
But I'm speaking strictly theoretical. I mean, not out of any sort of experience here. But given what I think I have learned that the Bible is teaching about the nature of human evil, it does seem to me possible that one, certainly not the only reason, and that's why what you're saying is very helpful, but one possible reason why we wouldn't, that there would be a kind of resistance and a stubbornness, is not merely fear and is not merely pain, mm-hmm. but ultimately a kind of attitude, an underlying attitude that says, I wanted you to create me better than I am, God, and I'm going to refuse to accept myself since you didn't do that.
That's one.
Yeah.
But I think if you, and that's what I was kind of worried about when you said in the beginning it comes out of just rebellion. I think that's one answer.
Right.
But that's not the whole thing.
Yeah, I can buy that. Well, I started that interrogation because it does seem to me that if we have this faulty view of total depravity, what I think is a faulty view of total depravity, where we see literally everything I do is tainted, that it kind of plays into the mindset of the person who either out of this rebellion or maybe even more typically out of this pain and this fear is inclined to see themselves as basically rejectable, as hateable people. This total depravity just kind of plays into that perspective, that kind of pessimistic perspective toward themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think a more balanced view of total depravity is really important to achieve, so that we don't play into that.
I absolutely agree with that. And yet what comes to mind for me, Jack, is I think my perspective is that most people do have this sense of real worthlessness, that they just don't have any value at all. And if people really saw them, if they were really exposed, then they certainly would not be acceptable people. And so, and at least that's the way we live. We hide so much that must be how we believe. And I think that heaven has a lot to do with finally living at peace with the reality that we are loved, mm-hmm. and that we are valued. Because God will give us that in the biggest, most perfect way. I think that's what heaven's going to be like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I hope that. I hope that for everybody that I work with that has that incredible feeling of worthlessness, that they will live, I hope, heaven for them, so that they can live with that kind of peace internally.
Yeah.
Because so many people, Jack, they live in hell in that sense that I better not be found out, or everybody will see that I don't have the ticket, that I really am an imposter. And the way that lots of people actually avoid that, the way I avoided the hard things in myself, was to see the opposite, was to become a narcissist and only see the good in me. Okay. So we can actually go either way to avoid the reality of what we feel is true in us, that I'm a worthless person that's not really going to get loved. And that's a devastating reality for us. And so going back to this view that I need to understand that I am a sinner, is that I am depraved, that I am broken, is very, very important for me to understand my need for God. A narcissist like me especially needs to see that. And it's very important to see that I have value in God's eyes, and that there are ways in which I act that are truly good.
Yeah, it seems to me that maybe one of the things we need to emphasize in the doctrine is that it's human depravity, not Jack's depravity or whoever my individual depravity, because as you've been talking, it's so easy for people to think that I'm not like other people. I'm the only one like this. I'm the only one that struggles with sin in this way and struggles with these kinds of passions and these kinds of desires, mm-hmm. and these kinds of perceptions and attitudes. I'm the only one. So everybody else out there is fine and I'm not. That's part of what we need to come to recognize is the Bible is telling us the truth. It's just plain the truth. And regardless of what my gut is telling me, regardless of what life looks like to me and how I'm perceiving it, I need to listen to the voice of God in the scriptures, not the voice in my head telling me this is the way the world is. And I'm not sure how to get there, but in the final analysis, we need to take the Bible seriously. And the Bible is telling me, even if it doesn't look that way, even if I don't see it, what the Bible is telling me is human beings are depraved. Not just I'm depraved, human beings are depraved. And what that means is, the way I am, they are too.
And that's why I get, like last time when we recorded, I said, Jack, I really want you to give examples out of your own life, of your own depravity, your own mistakes, because that's really, I've said this a lot of times, so I'm going to say it again, people really, really, really do think, Jack's not that way, I'm that way, he wouldn't do that, I would do that, Christine wouldn't do that, I hope people don't think that, but they would do that, and so I'm really working at trying to expose the humanness in our lives so that people don't think that. But we're not exposing ourselves, Jack. In fact, as a culture, as a people, we're hiding from this vulnerability because we don't think we're going to be cared about if we're seen again.
Yeah.
Okay, but I want to address one other thing you just said, and that's that ultimately we have to understand that the Bible is true. And that the fact that we are loved by God is a reality. That is the truth that we need to be hanging our lives on. Yes. And we live in the world every day where healing can and should take place by the love of one person toward another. And if we only say, what I'm going to do is just believe that God loves me, and leave it at that, I'm not working out in my life what I need to through loving other people and allowing myself to be loved, which is a huge part of what the Gospels talk about.
Okay, could you say that again? I'm not sure I'm following you.
You don't get my point?
No.
Okay. If a person has this sense of feeling very worthless, they could think by what you said that they should do is just think, okay, God loves me, and I just need to go on with life, and that's it. And every time this sense of inadequacy or less than-ness comes up in my head, I need to just tell myself, preach myself a little sermon, God loves me, so get on with it. You know, chill, Christine, don't think that. Well, that's not the whole answer to what we need to be doing, what we're called to be doing in this life. Yes, that's part of it. But when I have this sense of inadequacy, which will permeate and work itself out in hurtful ways in my life, I need to be working on it.
Working on it. Help me with that.
Say one of the ways that my inadequacy works itself out in my life is I pretend that I'm better than I am, and I act haughty in regard to you because I'm afraid for you to see my inadequacy. Now, I might on one hand be saying, I'm not inadequate, God really loves me. But the reality is in my life, I'm acting haughty towards you. So it's not really working out in my life. It's not really...
You're not really
taking,
believing
the truth
it.
Isn't taking root in my life.
Right,
that's
exactly,
right.
Exactly.
And so I need to be working at the impact of this, looking at the reality of what is my haughtiness about? What's the impact on other people? What do I need to do to help me be a more loving person? Well, part of that is what we've been talking about today.
Right.
Do you follow?
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah,
both are very, very important parts. And,
yeah.
And I think what we do in the church is we say, just teach yourself a little lesson. Just say God loves you. But our lives are hurtful and hurting each other terribly because we want to deny the reality of, in my example here, our haughtiness.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I'm not sure that I would even articulate it in terms of both. There's really only one thing that we need to do, and that is to believe what the truth about what the scripture is saying, but believe it in the sense that we live our life in the light of it. That is, we hang our hat on it. Our whole life is permeated by the substantial reality of the truth of what the Bible is saying in exactly the way that you've just described. I think what the Bible would say is, if you just tell yourself that this is true, that's an empty faith. That's a faith without content. That's a faith that is, it's like a corpse. It's like a dead body. It has no soul in it. That's the way James describes it in chapter 2 of James. That's just really not a real authentic faith at all. An authentic faith will act in the way that you've just described. It will not believe it just as a notion that it sticks in its head. It will believe it in the sense of a notion that rules my behavior. It makes me decide to change the way I relate to people, to change the way I relate to the world, change the way I relate to God.
But how do I get there is also the question. How can I change something that I don't see? Like, what I used myself again in the example earlier was, how can I change this veneer of I'm really great if I really think that's the way I should be? Well, I'm going to have to really look at how that impacts other people. I'm going to look at, you know, there's just a whole process to how do I get to the place where believing what God says and how I act are all wound up in the same ball.
Exactly, yeah.
And right. That's the process of life.
Right.
And as we're talking here, I'm realizing that we're only skimming the surface of trying to help people understand this. It's very difficult to articulate, but this is the stuff of life as I see it.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And it's the stuff of sanctification, which is what, you know, our whole discussion is all about. That's how we become sanctified, is as we, to use your language, work out the relationship between what God says is true in the Scripture and the actual attitudes and behaviors that I take into the world. Working out and integrating those is the stuff of sanctification.
And I have to do it with hugely open eyes. I have to be doing it with an allowance of other people to speak into my life. Mm-hmm. I need to do it with a risk of vulnerability. I need to do it with great intent, because it's not just going to happen.
Right, right.
Okay.
And I think that's what Paul says, work out your salvation with fear and trembling.
Because it's a tough one, baby.
Yeah.
It's a really tough one.
Yeah.
Someone came up to me in church and we were talking about some issues with our kids and, you know, how difficult it is to be parents. And we were talking about that, and this other lady comes up and she goes, you know, it's just that life thing. It's just a tough thing. It's just that life thing. And I said, that's it. That's the problem. It's that life thing. It's just a hard one to work out. Okay, will you briefly just articulate the main points, what we've been trying to say this last hour?
Okay, well, our main agenda here was to try to explore the meaning of the doctrine of total depravity. It's a doctrine that I believe is taught by the New Testament, but it becomes problematic. How are we to understand what that doctrine means? Does it mean that literally everything that I do and say and think and see is somehow insidiously corrupted and polluted and tainted by evil? That's one possibility. Or does it mean that as a creature made by God, created by God to do nothing but God-like good things, that there's this reality within me that always finds a way of making me do evil things instead of the good things I was created to do? What I suggested is, I think both of those views of the doctrine have some important things to teach us, and that the truth lies somehow in both of them. I think the first one, where everything, the view that everything that we do and say and think is tainted, can be kind of unrealistic and overly pessimistic, and doesn't really get to the heart of the matter, because the other view is true. We were created by God to be good people and to do good things, so it shouldn't surprise us at all if we are capable of godlike, noble things of real dignity. But in fact, we are broken in the sense that the same person who can do good can also do evil, horrendous evil. But that first view has an important thing to teach us, and that is, things are not always what they appear on the surface. And we need to be willing to take a humble, realistic, hard look at our lives, analyze them, and recognize that there can be depths of evil in my actions that are not at all obvious. And in that respect, the first view has a lot to teach us.
Have you ever wondered what the first Christmas was like for Mary? The angel Gabriel appears to her and announces that she is to have a son who will be the long-awaited Messiah. With the special Son of God as her offspring, Mary probably thought that her life would be a success. It would be altogether joyous, peaceful, and glorious. But it didn't turn out that way. In his News and Views article, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, Jack Crabtree illustrates how the first Christmas story went against Mary's and our expectations. It was chaotic, messy, and sad. Jack writes that the rebirth of our spirits will proceed along the same lines as the Christmas story began. It's going to be messy, shooting all our expectations to pieces. Our lives will be a growing awareness that the path to hope and victory will be painful, disappointing, chaotic, and marred by evil. But true believers will, just like Mary, treasure the promises of God so deeply and securely in their hearts that no amount of messiness or evil will extinguish them. Call McKinsey Study Center for your free copy of the article, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas.
Here at Christianity at Work, we are asking people for financial support. We also are asking people for feedback regarding how this program has impacted their lives. Has it ministered to them? Has it given them a new look at an old subject? Has it addressed a family problem or a personal problem? What kind of impact has it had on your life? Let me read you a letter from one of our listeners. I wanted to take a few moments this morning to write and to express to you how much I have enjoyed your radio program. I am not usually in my car on Sunday nights, but this particular evening I was. Immediately I was drawn into your and Jack's conversation. I pulled over to the side of the road to jot down your phone number and called the next day to receive more information about the ministry. Recently, you have been speaking of the single life and the factors that must be considered before entering into a marriage commitment. Although I have been married for 12 years to a wonderful man, much of your discussion is pertinent for us as well. I want to thank you for sharing your personal experiences concerning your relationship with your own husband. Several of these examples have depicted my own feelings, many of which I felt a bit guilty for and not certain how they might be verbalized without causing hurt or misunderstanding. Through your ability to articulate your feelings, I've been able to understand my own better. I look forward to listening to you and Jack and always enjoy receiving word from you. Like most Americans, I receive a fair amount of mail on a regular basis, but when I see Christianity at Work on the envelope, I am anxious to open and read its entirety.
That's very kind.
It's a very kind letter, and it really warms my soul. I think this is a very authentic letter. This person really is receiving benefit from what we're doing. And I would really encourage people who value this program and who have benefited to write and to tell us. It would be very encouraging to us. And also, as I said in the beginning, really encourage people to think about supporting it. If it's been of value to you, help us continue.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKinsey Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKinsey Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKinsey Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKinsey staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKinsey staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKinsey Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKinsey, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKinsey Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKinsey Study Center, thank you for listening.